Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaky Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy four, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summer-music-raffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews author Ted Chiang about his new book of science fiction stories titled Exhalation. Then, at 11:30, Black Book Talk talks to Lua Ubunufu, the author of Cage the Locked, My Personal Experience with Circumstantial Depression. Then, from noon to 10 p.m., it's our live broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 46 years of American-made arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local artisans, and local music in downtown Portland. Open every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more is available at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Ted Chiang. Chiang graduated from Brown University with a degree in computer science and is a graduate of the Clarion Writers Workshop, the premier workshop for writers of science fiction and fantasy. By day, Chiang works as a technical writer in the software industry, but he is also one of the most celebrated science fiction writers of our time. A slow writer, having written under 20 stories in the last 30 years, Ted Chiang has nevertheless won 27 of the major science fiction fantasy awards, including 4 Hugo Awards, 4 Nebulas, and 4 Locus Awards. His work has been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories, and his short story, Stories of Your Life, was the basis for the Academy Award-nominated film Arrival, starring Amy Adams. The arrival of Ted Chiang's second collection of stories, Exhalation, is thus a significant event in the literary world. In that spirit, for only the third time ever, the New York Times included a separate section in its Sunday edition dedicated solely to a short story, in this case to one of Ted Chiang's. With starred reviews from Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Bookpage, and Library Journal, Exhalation has been heralded by Colson Whitehead as lean, relentless, and incandescent. Blake Crouch adds that Ted Chiang has no contemporary peers when it comes to the short story form. His name deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Carver, Poe, Borges, and Kafka. Every story is a universe. Every story is a diamond. You will inhale Exhalation in a single, stunned sitting because true genius doesn't come along nearly as often as advertised. This is the real thing. Karen Russell says Ted Chiang writes with such a matter-of-fact grace and visionary power that one simply takes on faith that his worlds and his characters exist, whether they are human or robot or parrot. He is the rare author who makes me feel also that he believes in his readers, in our integrity, and our imagination. And finally, Asia Gable says, there's so much excellence in the labyrinth of ideas and Exhalation. Machines that question free will, AIs that challenge love, software that shapes memory. What truly astounds is the tenderness that pulses through each story like a heartbeat. When I read Ted Chiang, I am reminded not only of what might be, but what is, our own humanity, realized again and again through wonder, language, and empathy. He is not only at the top of his genre, but a true storyteller, and one of our most skilled and fascinating. I'm so excited to live in a world where Ted Chiang is writing. Welcome to Between the Covers, Ted Chiang.
Thank you. That was quite an intro.
Well, you were a student at Clarion Writers Workshop, and then later on you were a teacher at the writing workshop. And that workshop, students live together for 6 weeks, and each week a different teacher comes for a week. And I've never done Clarion, but when I took a workshop with Kelly Link, one of the things that struck me, having only taken more conventional literary writing workshops, was how different the approach was, that she was drawing on a different tradition of sensibilities, of reader expectations, and there were different ways she would look at tropes within story structure. And I know your approach to fiction is going to be particularly yours. It's not going to be representative of science fiction and fantasy versus literary workshops. But I still think it would be interesting to maybe start there a little bit with some of the things that are particular to the way you approach a short story. One of the things that you said is that you've always been drawn to clear explanations, that a great explanation is not just useful, but can also be beautiful and even thrilling. And I think in a sense, we can view your stories as sort of as beautiful, thrilling explanations. So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit about this, your interest in fiction writing in a sort of explanatory mode.
So when I was young, say, 11 or 12, I was reading Isaac Asimov's fiction and his nonfiction. For his nonfiction, I remember, I still remember some of the explanations that he gave for certain fundamental concepts, like how Eratosthenes estimated the diameter of the Earth using just shadows, or how Cavendish estimated the mass of the Earth using just, some lead weights hanging from thread. And I remember, this kind of thrill of understanding of just when an idea became clear, that it was a really profound experience. And I think that some science fiction can achieve a similar quality. In some ways, I think it is a way of evoking in readers the same thrill that scientists have when they make a scientific discovery, when they're uncovering new knowledge. They experience a real visceral excitement. And I think that some of the awe or sense of wonder that we associate with science fiction is very similar to that awe that scientists experience. So when I write science fiction, one of the things that I'm interested in is trying to recreate that experience, having that experience where the reader, along with the protagonist, gains some new insight, some new way of seeing the world. I think that can be a really powerful experience. And I think that's something that I find from reading nonfiction about science and in reading science fiction, and that's something that I value a lot.
So let's take that idea of approaching or aspiring for a beautiful and thrilling explanation in a story, and look at the first story in the collection, the Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate. What is an explanation that sort of undergirds that story for you?
Well, that story is not so much about elucidating a particular scientific idea. That story is more about trying to reconcile oneself to the idea of fate. And can you understand fate and destiny as being something positive rather than the more typical negative associations of sort of doom and helplessness? Is there a way to accept the fact that some things are inevitable or some things can't be changed, but find maybe solace in that rather than discouragement or doom?
Well, can you speak to the story set up for this story, both the way you take Kip Thorne's view of a time machine and twin it with a setting in ancient Baghdad.
So it's a time travel story, but it's also an attempt to emulate 1001 Nights. I thought it would be interesting to combine those two, because time travel stories, they often have a recursive element, because your characters may be traveling back to the same moment in time multiple times. And 1001 Nights is characterized by these sort of nested stories, where someone tells a story in which someone else tells a story in which someone else tells a story. So, you know, that seemed to me, you know, that there might be some compatibility between those two. And again, I thought that the idea of acceptance of one's fate, you know, that is one of the pillars of Islam. And so I thought that an Islamic setting might be an interesting place to tell a story about time travel where you can't change the past.
And what about Thorne's idea of a time travel door rather than a vehicle was compelling to you in this setting too?
Okay, one of the things that I liked about Kip Thorne's, the type of time machine that Kip Thorne invented, was that it seemed very tangible to me. It seemed concrete in a way that the more common sort of DeLorean Back to the Future kind of time machine seemed kind of hand wavy. So I guess in one sense, Kip Thorne's version of a time machine, that is something that I think someone in medieval times could make sense of, whereas, say, the DeLorean from Back to the Future, I don't think someone in the medieval era would understand, you know, what are these numbers, this numeric readout. You know, right. they can't conceptualize what a numeric readout is. That doesn't make sense to them. But a pair of doors, you know, I feel like that's something that you can demonstrate. And also, you know, the idea of, you know, this vehicle sort of magically vanishing and reappearing, you know, that seems very, that seems like something from a fairy tale. And yeah, again, yeah, I think it's sort of hard to reason about how that works. Whereas the, you know, the sort of pair of doors that Kip Thorne proposed, you know, when I thought about it, it's like, you know, I can sort of reason about it, how, you know, how to make use of that. I can make sense of it. I can, you know, I can sort of extrapolate how it will work in a way that, you know, with the flying DeLorean, I think, you know, that is, I would just have to take the creator's word for it.
Yeah. Well, I want to return to this. The first thing you said about this story, which I think is true about a lot of your stories, is often taking a premise that might be otherwise viewed as sad or despairing, and find, like you're saying here, this idea of fate, and then trying to portray it in a way where we could have solace in it. Because one review of this collection described Exhalation as Black Mirror for optimists. That seems interesting in a way that it's both are conceptually driven and puzzle-like, but unlike Black Mirror, Exhalation isn't cynical or dark at all. And Joyce Carol Oates' review in The New Yorker is titled Science Fiction Doesn't Have to Be Dystopian. And it feels like in most time travel stories, people are going back to right or wrong, or motivated to right or wrong, or to make amends, or to stop an evil act in history. So to discover that one can't change the past would, in most of those stories, be a very discouraging or sad thing. So I was wondering if maybe we could unpack that a little more, if you could talk more about the impulse to portray it as otherwise.
I feel like there are two separate questions there. One is sort of the question of how often is science fiction pessimistic or dystopian, and, you know, Black Mirror being sort of an example of that. And then there's the question of reconciling ourselves to fate or the unchangeability of the past. Okay, so in terms of the first question, for a long time, science fiction was associated with a sort of techno-optimism or sort of a boosterism of technology. And, you know, I think that was a reflection of a general attitude of optimism about the future as a whole and technology in particular. Then, as attitudes changed, you know, science fiction also changed, and then you started seeing a lot more dystopian views of the future, more explorations of the downsides of technology. You know, we've seen some of that sort of replayed again in the last 20 years, that specifically in terms of digital technology, the dot-com booms, the various dot-com booms, and, you know, the various revolutions in personal computing technology. There's a period of immense optimism about them and their ability to transform the world. And then more recently, there has been a reaction and a recognition of all the negative ways that they have and could continue to affect the world. So Black Mirror is probably a product of, or a reflection of, you know, this more recent, more pessimistic view of technology. I guess in terms of discussing the implications of a new technology, I guess I personally am more interested in stories that make a good case for both. Because I think, you know, pretty much all technologies, there are good arguments in favor of them and there are good arguments against them. And I think, you know, in general, it's important for us to recognize that there's no technology that is simply one or the other. There's been no invention for which undiluted optimism was the appropriate, you know, response. But also, there's no technology for which unmitigated pessimism was the appropriate response. And so I think that it's important to recognize that you know, there are both positives and negatives, and we should ideally, you know, make considered decisions about technology in light of the advantages that they could bring and the harm that they could bring. And so that is something that, in the stories of mine that deal with a new hypothetical technology, that is, I think, the approach that I am trying to take.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to the writer Ted Chiang about his latest collection, Exhalation. I wanted to ask you about science in relationship to your stories. You've talked about the idea of the critic John Clute, the notion that certain scenarios are easily storyable, meaning they are well suited to be told as story. And you've also quoted Faulkner before as saying, the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself, and said that science on its own does not have enough to sustain a fictional narrative, and that for you, that is where science fiction comes in, the use of science in fiction to illuminate the human condition. But I was curious about storyable versus non-storyable in your mind, because I would imagine that many of the philosophical and scientific ideas that inspire your stories, others would see as unstoryable. Is it the challenge of taking an unstoryable idea and making a story out of it that motivates you, or do you simply see these as storyable from the outset?
It's not a contrarian impulse that motivates me. I'm not looking to prove that things are storyable when they don't seem storyable. When I was talking with John Clute about storyable ideas. It was in the context of why there aren't more novels addressing climate change. And he thought it was maybe because climate change was not a very storyable subject. And if I were motivated by a contrarian impulse, I probably would have immediately set out to try and write something about climate change. But I have not, because, yeah, I guess I wasn't trying to, you know, prove him wrong or anything. I guess the things that I write about, they are subjects that I find myself just thinking about again and again without really intending to. So they are the things that obsess me in some sense. I wind up thinking about ways in which I can dramatize what I find interesting about these ideas. So I wind up trying to come up with dramatic scenarios to illuminate these philosophical questions.
Well, I wonder, like I was saying, maybe your story ideas might not seem storyable until you've done them. Maybe in a way you're showing the way they can be storyable. Because I think of, say, like writers from, say, Richard Powers to Jeff Vandermeer, who are sort of struggling with making story out of climate change. I'm wondering if maybe in 30 years, 20 years, it will become storyable through these gestures of trying to make it storyable.
I think probably there are a lot of things which seem unstoryable until someone actually does it. And then, in retrospect, we see like, oh, yeah, it was obvious all along. I mean, it wasn't obvious, but when someone first comes up with the idea, then, that offers a way for other people to think about that idea and to think about it in story terms and as something that can be a dramatic vehicle.
Hmm. Well, you were part of a multimedia project of interspecies translation, of which the written component became your story, The Great Silence, from the point of view of endangered Puerto Rican parrots. And one thing behind the story is the Fermi paradox, that despite how vast the universe is and how old it is, there's no signs of life anywhere except on Earth. And the narrator observes that even as humans search for extraterrestrial life in the great silence, they can't hear the voices and messages and cries being sent from all the species here on the planet that they share. And I wonder if this comes back to the question of storyable. The stories that we tell are usually human-centric. If it simply is more storyable to imagine traveling into space and exploring and problem-solving with us at the center than it is to listen to and contend with the desires and needs of other creatures that we are around all the time.
The idea of exploring outer space, I think part of the real reason it's appealing, and I can't deny that, I have an emotional attachment to that idea, but I think part of the reason it's appealing is it reminds us of the idea of being on the frontier, of being pioneers. It's a kind of story that we grew up with, especially in America, that we grew up with the idea of pushing ever outward. So I think that's a kind of narrative which we can also impose on space travel, and that makes it something appealing and sort of resonant for us. And likewise, the idea that there might be things out there, I think, that fits very well with that narrative. By contrast, recognizing the intelligence or acknowledging the experience of animals on Earth, that I think is probably troubling to us. I think we resist it because historically we have treated animals very badly. We're not consciously trying to denigrate them, but acknowledging their experience or trying to give them greater status as agents or as, you know, ethical actors or beings worthy of ethical treatment, that forces us to confront the enormity of, you know, what we've done in the past, and that's uncomfortable. So that's not something that is something that's, I don't, that's not something that's really attractive to a lot of people.
Well, one of the things that the story of the Great Silence points to is maybe a failure of human imagination around this yearning for otherness when we have the otherness right next to us, and the ways human imagination might even work against us. And it reminded me of the essay that you wrote in BuzzFeed about our fear of artificial intelligence and how it is, how you think it's really a misplaced fear that is really the fear of ourselves within a capitalist society. And I was hoping maybe you could just unpack what you were exploring in that essay a little bit for us.
That essay is a response to some of the articles that we've been seeing more recently about the fear that a super intelligent AI would be created and then take over the world and possibly destroy humanity without necessarily intending to, but just as a side effect of it pursuing the goals that we programmed into it. And I thought that this fear made no sense, that there'd be no way that, there'd be no reason to think that a super intelligent AI would do these things, which seemed completely ridiculous. And it seemed to me that this scenario could be better understood as kind of a fear of being outcompeted by better capitalists than we are. The idea that an AI might be better at capitalism than any human is, and thus it might crush us the way that successful corporations crush other companies and also anything else that gets in their way. So yeah, it seemed that, you know, the behavior that some people were attributing to super intelligent AIs, you know, a kind of victory at any cost, no holds barred, damn the consequences kind of attitude, those are all attributes of late capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like, you know, they are kind of projecting onto these hypothetical super intelligent AIs, they're projecting onto them the characteristics that we practice, that we praise in companies now, to some extent. We praise Silicon Valley companies. People invest in them precisely because they are ruthless, because they established complete market dominance. Mm-hmm. That's what investors want from a company that they are putting money into. But that's also what we seem to fear from a super intelligent AI.
There's a quote by Annie Dillard that it was important to you. You have been sent here to give voice to your own astonishment. What speaks to you about that quote?
I think that quote succinctly sums up why I'm a writer, why I think a lot of people are writers. It's because there is something that you find interesting, and other people, they currently don't find it interesting, but they could if you can explain it to them correctly. If you can explain to them why you find it fascinating. And I think that is in a lot of ways what the job of the writer is, trying to convey your excitement or your fascination or your amazement at some idea, something which, you know, if it's presented poorly or unexplained, you know, seems just bizarre or nonsensical. But if you can explain it to them the right way, they will be amazed in the same way that you are amazed.
I love that. Well, it was a pleasure having you on Between the Covers today, Ted.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're talking today to the writer Ted Chiang about his second collection of stories, Exhalation. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. Up next, we have Black Book Talk, talks featuring Liwa Ubunifu, the author of Caged and Locked, My Personal Experience with Circumstantial Depression. Then from noon until 10 p.m., it's our live remote broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click donate.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for our live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.